A new NASA leader and searching for life on distant ocean worlds. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. NASA now has a new leader, albeit temporarily. The Trump administration named Sean Duffy, the current Secretary of Transportation, to be the interim NASA administrator at the same time. So how does this new change in leadership impact the space agency? And how do people at NASA feel about Duffy? We'll speak with NASAWatch.com's Keith Cowing about those questions and the future of the space agency. Then, on one of Saturn's icy moons, scientists are looking for potential signs of life. Even though this moon has a harsh and icy environment, scientists believe it could hold microbial life. We'll speak with Southwest Research Institute's Chris Glein about finding life on distant frozen worlds. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? NASA now has a new leader, although temporarily. The Trump administration recently appointed Secretary of Transportation Sean Duffy to the space agency as interim NASA administrator. This new role comes after recent news that President Trump rescinded Jared Isaacman's nomination just weeks before the role was supposed to be filled. Plus, Duffy's new position comes right before Congress makes a decision on NASA's future budget. Here to talk more about the future of NASA and how a new administrator could impact the space agency is Keith Cowing. He's the editor at NASAWatch.com, which is an independent organization not affiliated with NASA. Keith, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, Keith, so let's talk about this, say, surprise interim leader for NASA. Where did this come from, and what do we know about the new interim administrator of NASA?
Well, all right, surprise, let's see. The president of the United States pick somebody who's already running another cabinet agency to run another one at the same time. He used to be on Fox TV. His wife still is. And he's a former reality TV star. So color me surprised. No, not at all.
Yeah. So let's walk me up to this point as to why Sean Duffy, the current FAA administrator, was picked for this interim leader. Who was at the helm of NASA before this?
Helm is an issue here. If you go to the, even though Mr. Duffy is technically the interim administrator, however that happens, he made a brief appearance last week at NASA headquarters, but he's not there now. And the question is, well, when he's not there, who runs the place? And if you go to the leadership page, Janet Petro is still listed as the interim administrator. Well, she's not. Then it has Vanessa White. Well, is she in charge? Or, you know, and so you don't know who's supposedly in charge. In reality, it's Brian Hughes who's the chief of staff. But there's still a question, and this happened before, who's actually in charge of NASA on a day-to-day basis? That's not exactly clear.
And efforts to get someone into that appointed and confirmed position of NASA administrator fell short with Jared Isaacman. Do we know what's on the horizon for a permanent NASA administrator?
Well, first of all, why did they pick Mr. Duffy to be the co or whatever, pick your title, of NASA? I don't know. Why did they pick him to be the Secretary of Transportation? He was a former congressman for a number of terms, so he clearly understands policy. But why transportation? And if transportation, why NASA? Oh, well, NASA has things with wings, and so does transportation. I don't know. Honestly, don't know. That's something within the president's inner circle that you'd have to, you know, investigate. In terms of getting a permanent NASA administrator, they do have a deputy nominee, but nobody's really heard much from him since he was picked. And supposedly now there's three or four people being vetted. The president has turned to the Space Force / space military world for some advice. What that means in terms of whether it'll be Space Force X, Space Force people or military people or people who work in that realm, don't know. I'm told they have a short list of three or so people and that they were hoping to make a selection soon. Maybe that's why Mr. Duffy is in there on an interim basis, because they have somebody in mind. I don't know. I'm guessing.
Right. And we know that we should set the caveat that this is a lot of speculation at this point, right? We know with the Isaacman pick, when that was rescinded, that takes a very, very long time to get somebody vetted through the congressional process, to those hearings, to that confirmation. Do we expect that this, whomever is on this short list, is going to take nearly the same length of time for this process to go through, and NASA could be without that permanent leader for many, many months to come?
Well, Brian Hughes, the chief of staff, said it could be 6 or 8 or 9 months. Okay, that's a number I can say 2 to 5 months. The weird thing about Isaacman is that he filled out all those papers. There's an extreme amount of vetting paperwork that you have to go through, including all his donations and companies and everything like that. And then suddenly, the president proclaimed, you know, like from Casablanca, I'm shocked to learn that he gave money to Democrats. Well, it was the thinly veiled reason to get rid of him because he was a friend of Elon Musk's, I guess. So the story's being told. But that took many months because they had to go do the round of visits to members of House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, the committee members, sit and chat with them, talk to some other people in the White House and so forth and get a lay of the land. And if there's three of them, then three of them need to go around. Or if you pick someone, you send that person around. And then, you know, you've got to get on the calendar for the Senate hearing to be, you know, run through the confirmation gauntlet. And then that has to go to the full Senate. And each one of those things takes time. And then it's, you know, it took a long time to get Jared Isaacman to that point. I'm led to believe, but it's easy to be led to believe here in Washington, that the next person will be picked with a fast track in the Senate in place. And I will believe that when I see it.
Yes. Fast track and Senate don't normally go hand in hand.
No.
let's talk a bit about what we can expect. And again, this is all speculation, what we can expect with Sean Duffy at the helm. You know, you mentioned that it's really unclear that he is the interim leader of NASA. It's still listed as Janet Petro, who was the acting administrator. Do you anticipate that Duffy will come in and really shake things up, change things, or will it be kind of just status quo until that permanent administrator gets appointed?
I think it'll be status quo. He's got two agencies to run, so he's clearly got to defer to, you know, folks at NASA to do a lot of the heavy lifting. My guess is that in reality, it'll be Brian Hughes who does that, and whoever is technically the acting, if they have to have somebody with a title, it'll be Vanessa Weiss, but it'll definitely be Brian Hughes who does that. And Mr. Duffy is a political appointee, a very loyal one to the president. So if the menu of things of he has to do says lay people off, cut budgets, he will do exactly what the White House tells him and not question anything he's asked to do. Now, if he's only there for a few months, that could be bad because a lot of these layoffs need to happen. If it's a few weeks, maybe nothing. Again, this is just speculation. It all centers upon when and if a next formal nominee for NASA is identified, dropped into the process. And then you got to say, well, all right, the guy's nominated, but how long will that take? So if you have a loyalist in place who is very, you know, dedicated to whatever the White House asks them to do, you can expect that whatever is in place in terms of budget cuts, impending layoffs, program cancellations, whatever, will happen.
That was going to be my next question, Keith, because with the prospects of Jared Isaacman and the kind of proposed budget cuts that the Trump administration was putting out there, there was a small bit of hope, whether even just a sliver of hope, that Isaacman might fight for it because, you know, he is a proponent of space exploration, right? But as you're saying now, with Duffy in this interim position and then whoever is fast track picked here, NASA's probably looking to cut all of those fundings and not fight for that budget cut that's on the horizon, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like a very good outlook for NASA at large, does it?
Well, if you look on YouTube, you see that early in his life, Mr. Duffy was a champion log roller. And, you know, I guess rolling a log right now to keep bad things from happening or things from getting out of control is the trick du jour. You know, but again, if there's not going to be a formal NASA administrator until September or October, which is sort of the guessing in the insider's game here, then he's going to be acting administrator for 3 or 4 months with a person as the chief of staff at NASA, Brian Hughes. There's not much delay in getting stuff back and forth between the two of them. So if it's time to cut, they're going to cut. And the game seems to be right now that they want to get as many cuts and cancellations in place while the presidential budget review for FY26 is still in place. When there's a formal budget, well, then that puts a kebab on things. But, you know, they've got a few more months before the end of the fiscal year. And if they can get all these layoffs and closures down and then have a real budget, they'll say, hey, well, you know, too late. We did it.
Mm-hmm. What are you hearing from the folks that are working for NASA, Keith?
I posted a graphic on Twitter where my watch kept, you know, I have one of those fancy watches, and it keeps buzzing, and it's things like, I quit, I jumped, I'm leaving, I've had it. I started NASA Watch as NASA Riff Watch back in 1996 when I have just left the agency and my friends were being threatened with a layoff, a much smaller one. And, you know, here I am 30 years later. I tried to retire, but I came back to do this because the threat of layoffs had reappeared. I can say in my 29.5 years of running NASA Watch and my 40 years with the agency, I have never seen more people more scared about more things, losing a career, a dream job, uncertainty, whether they should walk out voluntarily, wait to be laid off. It is collective calamity. And oh, by the way, we're exploring the universe and oh, the president wants us to go to Mars with people in 2 or 3, 4 years. It's just, and oh, we want to beat China. And what do? You take away the very thing that would allow us to beat China in space, people and budgets. Add that all together, you got a bunch of very motivated people who really kind of wonder from moment to moment, what is going on?
Keith, NASA for a very, very long time was always ranked as one of the top federal agencies to work at by its staff. You're mentioning there's so much uncertainty here, people are not sure. Do we really know what the longstanding implications of these budget cuts, these layoffs, these buyouts are going to have on NASA?
Well, if you cancel missions, you cancel the missions, you don't get the data, and that's that. If you turn a mission off before it's done, you lose the mission. You lose the data. And of course, if you lay people off, the people who take care of the data will be gone. And speaking from experience, I've seen this with my own eyes, tapes can get lost and data can get lost. And once it's lost, usually it's lost. But you lose your personnel. Oftentimes, the people who can leave most easily, the most skilled, go. The people who can retire, retire. And if they have a layoff, a RIF, reduction in force, it's the ones who can make the least claim to keeping their job. And that, unfortunately, means that younger people who came in and want, back in the days when diversity inclusion were actually a thing we practiced in America, it was the women, minorities, other groups that were either disenfranchised or underrepresented, all of which were brought into the agency, they will also be the most vulnerable. So you'll end up with an agency that's a fraction of its size, with a lot of its expertise gone. The diversity, it's going to be older, middle-class people. And, 5-10 years down the road, when we realize what a horrible mistake we've made, you have to rebuild the agency all over again. And you're going to lose 5 to 10 years of productivity with this agency. And guess what? China, Europe, everybody else is seeing the importance of this. They're trying to hire American space scientists.
That was going to be my last question there, Keith, is where are this talent and knowledge going if they leave NASA? Are they going into the private sector or what happens to this brain drain that is happening at the agency?
Well, it's a brain drain. I mean, again, I'll just say this. I worked at NASA. It's the most amazing group of people ever assembled to do some of the most astonishing things, explore the universe. Imagine that. You go to work every day doing that. These are very intelligent, motivated people. They can find something else to do. Maybe not as exciting. And they may never go back to space, the space industry again. These people are eminently employable. And, once you've lost them, a lot of them will say, well, if they're offered a chance in the future, I'd love to go back. But, you're going to lose expertise here. Full stop.
Keith Cowing is the editor of NASAWatch.com. Keith, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, searching for life on distant oceans.
We've continued to find new information, new discoveries.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. One woman is hoping to help our planet with experiences she gained by leaving it. Roberta Bonder, the first female Canadian astronaut and first neuroscientist in space, brings her knowledge as an astronaut back down to Earth in her book, Space for Birds: Patterns and Parallels of Beauty in Flight. Bonder talks about the similarities between birds and the way humans fly. Plus, she looks at the importance of preserving Earth's natural flora and fauna. We'll talk about that book next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about life on other worlds, like Saturn's moon Enceladus. Enceladus has a cryovolcanic plume. In other words, it's a freezing volcano. It also has a frozen ocean beneath it. Aside from these harsh conditions, life may be finding a way to survive. Chris Glein is a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute, and he believes that microbial life could potentially live amidst this harsh terrain based on its pH that he's measured from Earth. Here to talk more about searching for signs of life and measuring the components of water on a distant ocean is Chris Glein. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Hey, Chris, you've got some really interesting findings that you recently published. But before we start there, I want you to just give us a sense of what Enceladus is like. What do we know about this particular planetary body?
Enceladus is a small moon of Saturn. So that's about a billion miles away from us. It's very cold out there. The surface is covered by rock hard ice. But Enceladus is very interesting because it's erupting a cryovolcanic plume, we call it. So it's a plume made of tiny ice grains and water vapor that is erupting from the south pole of Enceladus. And it's been erupting for about 20 years now, at least. It was first discovered about 20 years ago.
And what do we know about those plumes? How are we able to observe them? Or is this something that we're seeing from our ground-based telescopes here on Earth, or have probes been there to look at these plumes?
There's a couple of ways we can study the plume. So one way, how the plume was first discovered, was we had a spacecraft called Cassini. This is a NASA mission that was operated in the last decade, and it was orbiting around the planet Saturn. And every once in a while, it would do a close flyby, we call them, where it would get close to Enceladus and snap a lot of great photos of the plume and the surface. And every once in a while, it also was directed to fly through the plume. So we had a spacecraft that was flying through this cloud of gas erupting from Enceladus, and some of the instruments on the spacecraft were able to measure different molecules. These are chemicals that were in the plume, and they could tell us more about where the plume came from. So that was one source of information. Cassini ended, unfortunately, in 2017 because it ran out of fuel after over a decade of great science. But for the past couple years, we've had the James Webb Space Telescope every year or so has taken a quick peek at Enceladus. And so we're continuing to collect science data as we speak.
Chris, in the paper that you published, you say Enceladus offers the best opportunity for exploring the chemistry of an ocean on another world. Why is it so important that scientists like yourself and planetary scientists are able to explore oceans on other worlds?
There's a couple of reasons. One reason is just cool to think about that we can actually probe a different ocean than the one that we're all familiar with here on Earth. The second reason is many of us are really excited, perplexed about the possibility of life outside of Earth, you know, on other planetary bodies. We think that liquid water is one of the key requirements to support life because liquid water provides this solvent for dissolving different chemicals in our cells that allow biochemistry to happen. So scientists like me and others were very keen on looking for liquid water. It's the follow the water mantra, right, in the search for life. We've learned that there are these moons in the outer solar system. I mentioned their surfaces are cold and covered by ice. But as you go down deeper, we think that the ice eventually gets heated and is melted to form subsurface liquid water oceans on many of these moons. It's actually thought that there's more liquid water beyond the orbit of Mars than there is in all of our ocean water here on Earth. So that's all potentially habitable real estate. That's where life could possibly survive. And Enceladus has done us this tremendous favor by erupting some of its water from the ocean into outer space, which is really helpful for a scientist because we can directly get samples of that ocean. So that's why it's the most accessible or best opportunity for exploring the chemistry of an ocean on another world.
Your research, and in this paper that you published, it looks at the pH of this ocean world on Enceladus. Now, when I go to measure the pH in say, my hot tub or my fish tank, I've got pH testing strips. I'm assuming Cassini did not have pH testing strips to dip into these plumes as it flew by. How did you actually go about measuring the pH of this ocean water?
Yeah, it's a great problem. So when Cassini was built and launched, we had no idea there was this ocean on Enceladus. So of course, there weren't these pH testing strips or some kind of equivalent mechanical device. We call it a pH meter where you can stick a stick inside of a water body and directly determine the pH. But once we discovered the ocean, then the pH emerged as something really important because it dictates how the chemistry of a liquid water body will behave. And as you note, if your fish tank or aquarium is at the wrong pH, that can actually kill your fish. So pH is very important. So we immediately thought, well, how can we determine this pH? We don't have a pH meter or a pH strips, but it turns out there are certain molecules that respond to pH in this very predictable manner. And we started to look for these molecules. And then once we found them, we could use them to construct a model to actually calculate the pH.
And tell me about what that model showed.
Yeah, so these molecules are phosphate molecules. These molecules contain phosphorus, chemically bonded to oxygen atoms. And that was a big discovery because phosphorus is one of the building blocks of life. It also turns out that there are different, slightly different forms of phosphate that contain different number of hydrogen atoms attached to them. And as the pH changes, the preference for holding on to hydrogen atoms changes in this very predictable manner. So we were able to use that behavior to then figure out, well, if we have a measurement of the hydrogen content of phosphate, then we could directly calculate the pH. And we were in business at that point.
That's fascinating and so resourceful. I love that.
Well, we got to try to do as best as we can with the data that are available because it's not a lot of data.
So what did that model show? What is the pH of the ocean water on Enceladus? And would my fish die if they were there?
Oh, they probably would, yes. So the pH was calculated to be around 10 to 11. And this is high. So we call this alkaline water. If the pH is very low, it's called acidic. If it's right in the middle, we call it neutral. Neutral is a pretty good place to live. Seawater is just a little bit above neutral. Neutral is at 7. Seawater is roughly around 8. We found that Enceladus' ocean is around 10 to 11. So it's quite a ways up there in alkalinity. Not a good place to be if you're a fish or a person for that matter. Your skin could partially dissolve and form soap under these conditions. But if you're a microbe, you know, a single-celled organism, there are microbes on Earth that are known to thrive under these kinds of pH conditions. So the high pH is not an impediment for life as we know it.
What is the quote? Life finds a way, right? There's always a when there's a will, there's a way there. And so this doesn't really throw out the idea that Enceladus could harbor signs of life or previously held life, right? There's a possibility that life is there.
That's totally right. And one of the other findings was that the plume also contains a lot of chemical energy. So there are certain molecules like CO2, carbon dioxide, methane, and hydrogen molecules that we find in the plume. And they show us that there's a huge source of chemical energy coming from Enceladus's ocean. And what's great about a huge source of energy, if you're a microbe, is even if the pH or other conditions aren't so favorable, you can put that energy to work to create adaptations to help counteract any challenges that the environment might throw at you. That's a positive message from the measurements.
What else do you need? I mean, Cassini was not meant to do this, so you got extremely resourceful with the data you have. Is there another opportunity to go back to Enceladus and really confirm some of these findings even more?
Great. So Cassini was a mission that keeps on giving. Even after the mission ended in 2017, we've continued to find new information, new discoveries in the data that scientists are continually pouring over in the years since then. It's like a greatest hits for what we call astrobiology, the study of life in the universe. We found phosphorus. We found many other different building blocks that life needs, like carbon-bearing organic molecules. These are the types of molecules that build biomolecules. We found nitrogen. Nitrogen is a key element you need to make things like DNA molecules and amino acids. I mentioned the source of chemical energy. We found almost everything that life needs. The only thing that's missing currently is sulfur, which is used in some amino acids. The spacecraft measurements just aren't conclusive as to the presence of sulfur. But almost everything else is available in that environment. So we have concluded that Enceladus is most likely habitable. It provides the kinds of conditions and the right stuff to allow life to survive.
That is an incredible finding. Is there any plans to follow up on that and send maybe another probe to see if you can find that sulfur?
Yeah. So we're excited because it looks like a great place to live. As you mentioned, life kind of finds a way, at least on Earth. One thing that Cassini was not able to do is we could not directly look for signs of life. We call these biosignatures. So these are certain molecules or different properties of molecules that we tend to associate with life. Like, you know, a DNA molecule is one example of a potential biosignature. But there are other more subtle biosignatures, like certain amino acids or distributions of amino acids. We couldn't find those yet because we didn't have the right technology, but scientists, and including myself, were continuing to develop the technologies and the approaches to send a future mission to Enceladus. And we're hoping that in the coming decades, we'll have that opportunity. It kind of takes a long time to develop these missions. So we're probably looking, I would say, 2 decades ahead, maybe in the 2040s and 2050s, when we can send a mission back to Enceladus. And this would be a mission that's driven primarily, as you mentioned, tidying up the search for sulfur. That's the missing ingredient. And then looking for direct markers of potential life that might have come from this ocean.
Finally, Chris, this is fascinating research that you were able to conduct on this data from Cassini and Enceladus. Is there applications for this geochemical modeling that you use to determine the pH on Enceladus for data from other planetary bodies?
Totally. Yeah, we're very excited about a different mission that has already launched called Europa Clipper. It launched last October after the hurricane came ashore. Then we launched the spacecraft. It's a beautiful launch, successful. Everything has been going extremely well. And now it's on its journey to Europa. That will arrive in about 2030. And we have the kinds of instruments that can measure molecules in plumes, measure different surface materials that might come from ocean water erupting onto the surface from the interior. These instruments are much more capable than the ones that were on the Cassini spacecraft. I wouldn't say that we'll find fish or direct signs of life, but we're going to make a lot more progress than we were able to with Cassini at Enceladus. And this mission, like I mentioned, it's already on its route to Europa. So if we just be patient for another 5 years or so, then we're just going to get a flood of data from Europa Clipper to tell us about a second alien ocean in the solar system. So we're really looking forward to that.
And I'm looking forward to hearing what you find, Chris. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Chris Glein, a planetary scientist at the Southwest Research Institute. And before we end this show, I'm inviting you to join the Central Florida Public Media family this summer. We're aiming for 100 new or rejoining monthly sustainers to support the independent news and programs just like Are We There Yet? That you love. Become a sustainer and get a special thank you gift, like an umbrella or a travel mug. You can find out more at cfpublic.org, and thanks for your support. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, NPR's app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Follow us on social media. Our handle on Instagram and Facebook is at @AWTYSpace. Aren't we there yet, space? Get it, AWTY. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reap. Our producer is Marion Summerall. And editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.